I have had the pleasure of getting to listen in to some of our speaker tonight's thoughts about the book that is the subject of our talk tonight during its production. And that has been a pleasure. I also, along with Stuart, had the chance to have an extended conversation with Jim about the book, this particular book, in our radio show, The Mystical Positivist, in earlier this year. And so I know that you are in for a treat, as ever. Jim is maybe the clearest, or at least one of the clearest speakers we've ever had in the store, and he sets himself the task of presenting spiritual ideas so that they are accessible to all. So I urge you to join me in welcoming one of the co-founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea, one of the most frequent, if not the most frequent speaker here at the store, back to Many Rivers, my good friend Jim Wilson.
Thank you for coming tonight. I'd like to start with just a few minutes of the kind of prayer of interior silence that the Guide to True Peace teaches. So I'll give a little bit of instruction or a little bit of guidance, and then we'll do it for a few minutes. In the Quaker tradition, it's called waiting worship. So think of yourself in a train station, and you're waiting for someone to appear that someone you're eager, like you're really eager. You've been waiting for this person for a long time, and you really, really want to see this person. So, but you don't know exactly when the train is going to arrive. It's like you're in the station, and while you're waiting for the train, it's okay. You might wander a little bit. Wander around the station a little, or you might even pick up a magazine for a bit, but you don't, get really involved with it because you're waiting for this presence. Okay. And that's the frame of mind that you want to keep. It's a very light touch. It's a very light touch. If you find that you've gotten too far out of the train station, just return to the train station. Settle your mind and wait for the presence to appear. Okay. So we'll do that for just a few minutes. Good evening, friends. What I'm going to talk about this book tonight, and this practice, and how I discovered it, and my relationship to it, and how, you know, what led me to produce this book. And if people have questions or comments at any time, you know, please feel free to. It took me over a year, a little over a year, to put this book together, and that was because I found a tremendous amount of material. In fact, the last 3 or 4 months was a struggle of what to include and what not to include. You know, like, here's the Guide to Two Teeth. Here's my annotation. So I finally, you know, winnowed things down to what I thought were the essentials. I discovered the guide shortly after I joined the Quaker meeting in Sebastopol, which I think was what, is that like 6 or 7 years ago now, something like that? And I was reading a book on Quaker history, and they mentioned the Guide to Two Peace as a book that had been, and actually remains, very influential, you know, like that. For example, in Quaker diaries of the time, people would say, I went to visit so-and-so, and before I left, I made sure I had my copy of A Guide to Two Peace, you know, with me. You know, like, so you get the impression that it was very widespread. It was originally published in 1813 by two Quakers. It was originally published anonymously, which... that wasn't common among Quakers, but it wasn't unheard of either. You know, like, But the two authors were William Backhouse and James Jansen, two British Quakers. And on the title page, they say, A Guide to True Peace, or A Method of Attaining to Inward and Spiritual Prayer, compiled chiefly from the writings of Archbishop Fenelon, Madame Guyon, and Miguel Molinos. Okay. So it wasn't that struck me, and I was going, well, who are those guys? You know, like, so I tracked down the three people who were mentioned were continental Catholic writers, not British Quakers or not even Brits, but they were contemporaries of the founders of the Quaker tradition. All of this was happening in the 1600s. And these three people were the principals in a movement known as Quietism. And so we'll talk a little bit about Quietism and its distinctive features. We just experienced one of the distinctive features, a formless interior prayer, as opposed to remembered prayers or rote prayers or prayers done, during specific hours. Both the Quakers and the Quietists shared that in common with each other. It happened in parallel, but they recognized each other very quickly. Initially, when the earliest Quietist was Miguel Molinos, a Spaniard who ended up teaching in Italy, and the initial reaction to him was very positive, and he had thousands of followers, and he set up houses of prayer for this kind of contemplation. And then there was a reaction that took place, and he was arrested, interrogated by the Inquisition, put on trial for 2 years, thrown in prison, where he died. Madame Guyon, who wrote a book called A Short and Easy Method of Prayer, was arrested 4 times, spent 10 years in prison. She was eventually released. Archbishop Fenelon wrote a defense of Madame Guyon, known as The Maxims of the Saints. It was his attempt to show that her teaching was not heretical. So the response to him publishing that work was to arrest him as well. And he was exiled from Paris, which in those days was a big deal, to be exiled from Paris in France. The Quakers in Britain faced a similar reaction. Many of the early Quakers were arrested, thrown in prison, many died there, for practicing this kind of heretical approach to religion, they shared a similar history and they shared a similar view, and the Quakers, both in England and America, became a major conduit for the transmission of the ideas of Quietism into the Anglosphere, and the culmination of that was the Guide to Peace. I became very interested, and because I'm the kind of person I am, I tracked down the source material, for the guide. The guide does not, it says based on, but it doesn't tell you. It's a practical manual. It's a teaching manual. Its purpose was to teach people the prayer of interior silence, both how to do it, obstacles that you may encounter, the basic point of view, and the fruit of this kind of practice, which would be union with God. And so it doesn't get into theological issues. It's not a treatise. It doesn't have, it wasn't written by academics. So they don't go, as Madame Boyan says, as Archbishop Fenelon says, or as Miguel Molina, what they did is, and it's very interesting, is they took passages and then they stitched them together, and they have their own, there's passages of their own prose intermingled with all this. It's kind of like a spiritual quilt. And what I find surprising is how well it works. You know, like, you know, when I was delving into it, I was going, it reads seamlessly, you know, like as you're going for it, you know, like as you're going from section to section, you don't see the stitching, you know, like, or maybe a better metaphor would be it's like a collage, you know, that's very well done, you know, like, so it has all these pieces from various sources, but it all somehow forms a unified whole. I think that's remarkable, you know, like, that they were able to do that, you know. I became so fond of this book that I carry it with me wherever I go, you know, like now, you know, like, and I have for years. So, and I just dive into it for a little inspiration, you know, like now and then. So, the first edition of the Guide to Two Peace that I read was a 1979 edition published by Pendle Hill. Pendle Hill is a Quaker center on the East Coast. and it was wonderful. It has an introduction by Howard Brinton, who was a significant Quaker in the post-war period. Very influential. And the 1979 edition was a reprint of the 1946 edition, which was, as far as I can tell, the first edition to be printed by a major publishing house, which was Harper's. You know, like, and in 1946, Harper's printed it. It got a very good response. And so the Guide to Two Peace has stepped out of its specific Quaker context, and you'll find it quoted in a lot of different places that aren't necessarily, you know, Quaker. For example, Paul Brunton quotes the Guide to Two Peace in one of his works. And I found it quoted in 12-step literature, you know, like which is, you know, really interesting to me. So it's becoming part of the spiritual heritage, you know, like, for everybody, as opposed to a specifically Quaker work. So they mention on the title page Guyon, Fenelon, and Molinos. And in my research, I was able to discover three additional sources. There was another French quietist by the name of François Malaval. And he was a contemporary of Madame Guyon. He was blind, and he wrote a book, A Quick Method of Raising the Soul from Meditation to Contemplation. And he wrote it in a dialogue form. And he was rounded up as well during this. The Inquisition came to visit him, and he signed, you know, he recanted, you know, like. But his dialogue, I discovered, I got a copy of his dialogues. They were translated in the 1930s into English, and they are really beautiful, you know, really. And what I discovered is that some of the metaphors that Malaval uses, Madame Guyon used, and those metaphors in turn were used in the guide, you know, like. So my feeling is that Madame Guyon was aware of Malaval. Although they could have even met, I don't know, you know, like, the specifics about that. And there was another man, there was a guy by the name of Jesse Kersey, and I found one paragraph in there, which is actually lifted from a book that he wrote, you know, like, in total, yeah. It's stitched into the fabric. I was able to track it down to this guy. Yeah. He was an early Quaker, British Quaker, you know, like, and, I think that's an original contribution of mine, that I was able to track that down. And another deep background is St. Francis de Sales, who wrote a manual on a short introduction to the devout life. And there are many passages in there which echo into the quietists and then subsequently into the Guide to Two Peace. I had such fun doing this. You should have seen me on the floor surrounded by all these volumes, googling passages and tracking down, you know, like it was great fun. I love doing that kind of stuff. So the end result is in here is you have the guide, and then you have the passage, like here, it's a Guiyang, chapter 1, page 9. And I found the edition that the Backhouse and Jansen used. And so I interpolate into the guide the passages that they were using so that you can see, you know, like, they don't do it exactly. Sometimes there'll be, like, a whole paragraph will be the same, but there'll be subtle shifts, you know, like, in how they present, you know, like, and sometimes they're quoting from more than one source, you know, like, they're quoting both Molinos and Guiyang, or something like that. And then I added my own comment, you know, like, so. And I use three different typefaces. I use an ordinary typeface for the guide itself, and I use italics for the sources that they come from, and then I use a sans serif for my comments, you know, like, so that you can clearly see the differences. And I sort of felt inspired to do it because Backhouse and Jansen did a literary spiritual quilt, you know, like. And I thought, well, I'm just going to make a bigger quilt, you know, like, I need a bigger quilt, you know, like, so that's what I did, and I found a lot more material, but like I say, I had to trim it and to make it useful to people, you know, like. So the material that the guide is sourcing goes back to the 1600s, like I said. So I love this sense of this continuity of this teaching over the centuries. You know, and I could have gone back farther, all the way to my man Dionysus, the Areopagite, in the 3rd century, but I had to stop somewhere. Like I said at my Quaker meeting when I was working on it, I said, it could be 1,000 pages long, and one of the members of the meeting says, I'm not going to read it if it's 1,000 pages. He said, but I will read it if it's 400, so. So let's talk a little bit about quietude. Are people at all familiar with this? I know Will is. So Quaker history is divided by historians, and Takwak, correct me if I make some. Takwak is a walking encyclopedia of Quaker history, but generally speaking, they divide it into three periods. And the first period is the beginnings, you know, and it's usually depicted as the beginnings were very dynamic, and there was this burst of spiritual energy and light into England, and George Fox and other preachers were wandering around England, and they attracted thousands of people. You know, like, they used to hold open air meetings, you know, and thousands of people would come, you know, like, and they set up their meetings, and it was very creative. It was also a period of immense conflict, you know, like, lots of them got arrested for heresy, and the Quakers were also a pain in the butt because they refused to bear arms, they refused to show proper deference to aristocrats, they wouldn't refer to them as you, they would only refer to them as thou, which seems like the reversal from our perspective. But at that time, thou was the second person singular. But if you met an aristocrat, you were supposed to use the second person plural because of their elevated status. It's kind of like when the queen says we, you know, and she's talking about herself. It's the same kind of relationship. You know, like, so at that time, you was only the second person plural. Thou was the second person singular. So they would refer to, they would say thou to an aristocrat, and they could get arrested for that. and they did get arrested for that.
Now, what was this time frame?
1600.
Mid 1600s.
Yeah. So, and they wouldn't take off their hat when they were in front of the judge, things like that, because they had this vision that all people were endowed by the inner light, we're equal in the presence of that light, and we're equally graced by the divine. And they wanted to reflect that in their actual behavior. I have to say, I read some of these things and I go, what a pain in the butt. But it's also hugely inspiring. So there was a lot of conflict. George Box, if you read his journal, was he arrested 8 times? Something like that. He would not take an oath, because in the letter of James and in the gospel, one of the gospels, Luke or Matthew, I can't remember, there's a passage where Jesus says, "Do not swear," at all. Period. Stop.
Take no oath at all.
And the letter of James, which is generally thought to have been written by Jesus' brother, James. Says the same thing. And so they would not swear. There's a verse in the George Fox song. "Will you swear on the Bible?" "No, I won't," said he, "for the truth is more holy than a book to me. For the book, it will crumble and the steeple will fall, but the light will be shining at the end of it all." So there you are. This band of so what makes them quietest? They don't sound very quiet. The reason they're quietest is because they contacted the source that gave them the strength to do this. It's found in that interior silence that we have the aglitza, that waiting worship. What is it Berkeley says, Takwak, when I came upon those silent assemblies? When I came into the silent assemblies, I felt the good in me raised up and the evil weakened.
Thing about how honor continues to this day.
Yeah.
I had a nose to nose with a judge in Philadelphia who came in, all to stand, and the men took their hats off, but the women didn't have to. And I wore my broad hat and had to keep on.
Thank you. So, one of the things that I discovered, and I just want to share with you some of my discoveries here. I love this kind of stuff, and I hope to share some of this enthusiasm with you. One of the things I learned was how a tradition will change when it moves from one region to another. And I practiced Buddhism for a long time, 30+ years, and I knew from the history of the transmission of Buddhism how it changed as it moved from India to China, or India to Tibet, or India or China to Japan. And I also had pretty good understanding of how America has changed Buddhism. But this is a really interesting example because it's fairly recent and we have a lot of documentation, and as I was studying that, I saw how Backhouse and Jansen, certain things got through from these sources, and other things they did not include at all. And the clearest example is this. Those three quietists that I mentioned, it was very important to them that their teaching of the prayer of internal silence be validated by the church fathers and Catholic saints. So that they will, their works are littered with quotes from those saints, you know, like, so that they would be considered orthodox, you know, like a non-heretical. It didn't work, but it was important to them to have that in there. In the Guide to True Peace, all of that is dropped. Not a single quote from a church father or a Catholic saint was transferred. There are a lot of quotes from the Three Quietists, but they didn't pick up any sources, you know, like from that. So that was very interesting to me, you know, like, so that's a change from Catholic France, Catholic Europe, to Protestant England. You know, like, so, and to me it was just such an interesting demonstration of, you know, when spiritual traditions move from one culture to another, some things are enthusiastically embraced and then other things just aren't. You know, like, they just aren't going to, you know, come through because of the sociology of the time. I'm not saying it's good or bad, you know, what they did. It's just I really noticed that. What they do quote is the King James Bible. In here, in a book of less than 90 pages, there are over 100 biblical citations, and you find very few biblical citations in the Continental Quietists. You know, like they're there, a few. You know, like, but you know, in Molinos, there's maybe 8 or 12, you know, quotes from the Bible, you know, something like that. He was very interested and connecting his teachings to the mystical tradition of the Catholic Church by referencing saints and stuff like that. Fenelon's work is called The Maxims of the Saints and consists entirely of quotes from church fathers, saints, and things like that. Madame Guyon, kind of a middle ground. You know, she references a few, you know, like, and she has a few biblical citations, but the way she wrote was kind of free association, or what did you call it before when we were talking about it? Not free association.
Stream of consciousness.
Stream of consciousness, except I have a reluctance about that because then people think of like avant-garde modern things,
right.
and that isn't what I mean. But she would write, you know, like this, and all her quotes from saints and biblical passages are from memory, or they're paraphrased, you know, like, and sometimes it's really hard to track down, you know, like she'll say, as St. Augustine said, and nobody can quite figure out, you know, like, where that came from, but she probably had something in mind, you know, like, but she was paraphrasing, you know, like, so that was a wonderful lesson to me, you know, like, about spiritual traditions, and how culture shapes them, and how they present themselves, depending on context, you know, like, and it's made me much more relaxed about, say, Western Buddhism. I used to have kind of a chip on my shoulder about, because I studied in Japan and Korea, you know, like, and I go, oh, they aren't really doing it, you know, like, oh.
Was there a consideration that we weren't doing it right?
Yeah, you know, that kind of thing, you know, like, and seeing this, you know, really, really, I said, you know, that's what happens. You know, different groups of people, you know, like, have different interests, they have different histories, and so different, they're going to express it in a different way, you know, like, so that's one, you know, really helpful lesson. The Guide to Peace made me more peaceful about that. But it also helped me to understand that from my perspective, the Quaker tradition is grounded in this contemplative realization. It's grounded in this interior silence. Everything comes from that. Everything emerges from that. Not all Quakers would agree with this interpretation. That's okay. You know, like, I'm fine with that. But as I tracked back and read some of, say, George Fox's letters or Barclay's Apology, those are very early Quakers, it became more and more clear to me that that's the beating heart of the Quaker tradition, you know, like this prayer of interior silence, which I found very rewarding, it's wonderful to see this kind of contemplative presence, within Western tradition, because since the 17th century, the 1600s, and the reaction to the Quietists on the continent, in Catholic Europe, and the great difficulties the early Quakers ran into, mysticism and interior silence, I mean, it really got hammered during that century. I mean, just hammered, and it's been difficult to have that understanding reemerge. I think that's why in the 20th century a lot of people turned to the East, because they wanted that they wanted access to that, that realm beyond name and form, that realm beyond thought. I know I was completely unaware that such teachings even existed in, in a Western context. So it was very rewarding to me to go, this is a universal teaching. It will find its way, it will emerge. It's like this spring which moves around and pops up, when conditions are right. Another thing I learned from this project is I call it the subtlety of silent contemplation. I learned something from this that is, I discovered that the Quaker community had created many editions of the guide. I forgot to complete my little spiel about Quaker history, didn't I? I talked about the first period, right, the early period. Let me backtrack, sorry. The second period in Quaker history is called the period of quietism. And it's during this period that the Quaker community was, by and large, a contemplative community. It was a contemplative community of lay people, so we often don't recognize it. It wasn't monastic, but its focus, if you read the what are called the disciplines in which meetings operated under, there's always these sections about interior silence and how you must, practice that on a regular basis, it behooves us, and we urge all our, all members of our meetings to, do this on a regular basis. And by regular, they often mean daily. The Guide to True Peace says, it would be good to do this daily. You should do this every day. And the third period of Quaker history begins in the mid-1800s, maybe something like 1830, 1850. Tockwalk would know the dates better than I. But the Quaker community suffered a series of schisms, because we love to schism. Human beings love to schism. I call it, I have this idea for a book called The Joy of Schism. and Protestants love to schism more than anybody. So the Quaker tradition, which up to that time had been pretty unified, broke into several, two major branches and a third branch, which doesn't have a large following but has an influence, an evangelical branch, which transformed the Quaker community into basically a Protestant church structure, and a liberal branch, which transformed the Quaker community into a universalist community of practitioners. And the third branch is called the conservative branch, an unfortunate name, but at the time they chose that name, what they were talking about was conserving the traditional Quaker faith and practice. it's among the conservatives that you will still find some women who will wear a bonnet, some men who will still wear a broad-brimmed hat, you know, like, and they preserve a lot of the customs that the traditional Quaker community had. What this manual, it turned my interest to that second period, which was a little over a century long, you know, like, and when I would read material from there, I just found it so inspiring. But what I also discovered is that modern Quakers have kind of distanced themselves from this second period. What they will do is, they'll talk about the first period as dynamic and creative and, you know, like, opening new territory. And then the Quaker community, the energy kind of died down and it withdrew and it was, you know, like, it became insular, blah, 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 blah. Never mind that it was the period of quietism in which abolition took root, but we'll bracket that. but it's depicted that way by modern Quaker historians, because modern Quaker historians are either evangelicals or liberals, and they emerge from schisms to that earlier period. So that's how they view it. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm saying that I discovered this period of quietism and I loved it. You know, I still do. You know, like, every time I come across material from that, I just find it so inspiring and so rewarding. You know, like, and it really opened up the door for me to this second period of Quaker history, Quaker faith and practice. You know, like, just, it's where I'm rooted, you know, like, in the Quaker tradition. You know, like, So I was going to be talking about what I call the subtlety of interior silence. One footnote I want to make is that there's a difficulty in vocabulary in this material from the second period, Quaker faith and practice, from the material of the Continental Quietists. They use the term meditation for discursive prayer, you know, like verbal prayer, or for visualization exercises, like the exercises of Ignatius of Loyola. So that's what they mean by meditation. They use the word contemplation to mean imageless prayer, you know, prayer without words. The Greek word would be apophatic, you know, like, and modern American Buddhists and Hindu practitioners have reversed these meanings. So they'll use the word meditation often to mean thinking about. There's not a lot of consistency here, but I'm just saying you'll often find that. I mean, they'll use the word contemplation to mean thinking about. You know, like a contemplation on beauty, you know, like, or a contemplation on, you know, like, on this subject or that subject, you know, like, and they'll use the word meditation to mean going beyond that kind of verbal, and that can be very confusing. As someone who practiced Buddhism for decades, when I first found this, it was very confusing to me, like, and until I figured out, you know, like, that, oh, wow, you know, like, they're using the words the exact opposite of the way I had become used to. So when Malaval says, a short treatise on raising the soul from meditation to contemplation, what he means is a short discourse on moving away from verbal prayer to interior silence. So if you access this material, keep that in mind, particularly if you have a background in Western Buddhism, Hinduism, or other Eastern practices. It can really trip you up. You know, like, so that's just a little tip. You know, like, so the first edition I read was the 1979 edition, based on the 1946 edition. And I, because, again, this is the kind of person I am, so I started getting other editions, and I noticed that there were changes made, you know, like, in these editions. There were editorial changes, right? So in the scriptorium. But so I got 15 different editions, and I laid them all out, you know, like, and I began to, you know, I compared them line by line, which I could do because it's a short work, you know, like, so, and computers are great for that, you know, like, so. So, in the, let's see, give you an example. It turned out that the 1979 edition was based on an edition that goes back to 1839, which wasn't long after the guy was created, which made a lot of alterations in the original text. You know, like,
the original being 1813?
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually 1815. Okay. The 1813 text was the earliest, and then it went through a process which the Quakers call discernment. You know, like, there was a communal discussion about it. The 1815 edition came out. All the material from the 1830 edition is in the 1815 edition, but the chapters are reworked. The order of the chapters has changed, and some of the paragraphing has changed. And they also added a little bit of material. All subsequent editions are based on the 1815 edition. It's better. I was surprised. I thought I would like the 1813 edition more, but it's a little confusing. It's like an in-house document. It assumes that you know certain things, you know, like, whereas the 1815 edition doesn't make these assumptions, you know, like, and it's more, and the order of the chapters is more stepwise, you know, like, so I can see why that happened. So
you have in late 1700 Job Scott, who was well understood, able to say things like, the blood of Jesus has no more efficacy for the removal of sin than the blood of bulls and goats.
Yeah.
He's talking about Christ.
Yeah, he's talking about
Christ. By the mid-1800s, he would have been smarter than that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
At that point, the peace testimony had come to mean accepting Christ as your Savior. And most of the Quakers in many communities in Indiana and Ohio joined the Union Army.
Join the Union Army. Join the Union Army.
So we have quite a transition.
So, thank you. You know, like, here's an example of some of the changes that took place. You know, like, let's see here. There's one that I really want to focus on. So, the 1946 edition. A lively sense of this presence will extricate us speedily from numberless mental wanderings, remove us far from external objects, and bring us nigh unto almighty power. So the 1815 edition. A lively sense of the presence of God will extricate us speedily from numberless mental wanderings, remove us from external objects, and bring us nigh unto our God. So one of the interesting things was the 1839 edition, 1946, 1979, removed the word God. You know, said lively presence. They said they would use all sorts of euphemisms, you know, like, but they tended to shy away from the way word God. And there were some passages which they simply dropped. You know, like the passage I was trying to look for says, the way of interior silence will teach you to despise the world, which perhaps you do already. So, why? This is very interesting. Why would they drop that? So, that was not a controversial statement at the time that that was given. In fact, if you read the early disciplines of the Quaker community at that time, they'll talk about despising the world. You know, like,
yeah.
But what do they mean by that? What they mean is the human world. They do not mean creation. And that was a distinction which was very clearly understood at the time. You know, like, so what they say, when they say despise the world, what they mean is despise the world of greed, despise the world of war, despise the world of contention, despise the world of, you know, like, combativeness and lust and those kinds of things. You know, like, they do not mean despise God's creation, the tree, the ocean, the birds, and the sky. You know, like, but by the time this edition came out, that distinction was not clear. You know, like, you know, when I first read it, I sort of went, eh. You know, like, when I first got a hold of older editions, I go, like, what's with that? You know, like, and so it as I read more and more, you know, like, in the Quietist literature, I go, oh, this is what they're teaching. They're teaching to turn, what they mean is to turn away from this world of human strife, anger, you know, like, and that kind of thing. But times change, the meaning of words shift a little, and so it didn't become clear, and maybe they were right to drop that passage, you know, if it, or they might have expanded it to, you know, like, clarify.
Despise is a very loaded word.
It is. Yeah.
Maybe reject.
It's really quite strong. Yeah. The other change that took place is much more recent, 1990s. And it took place in an online edition, which I downloaded, printed out, and compared to the rest of them.
Of course.
And what they did here. Now this is really interesting.
Wait. Who are you speaking of? What sector, you know, of the 1990s?
A gentleman by the name of Hal V. Worthington. He has an online site in which he has tons of early Quaker stuff. You know, like. But what I discovered is that he's altered it in line with his own point of view. And he doesn't tell people. You know, like, what he does is, I mean, this is one of the dangers of online research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, like, said, but I say unto you.
Yeah, so listen to this change. The online edition reads, "We must retire from all outward objects and silence all the desires and wandering imaginations of the mind, that in this profound silence of the whole soul we may hearken to the ineffable voice of the divine teacher. We must listen with an attentive ear, for it is a still small voice." Okay. Now.
Who is saying that?
Okay. That's the online edition.
Okay.
1990s. Here's the quote from all editions of A Guide to Two Peace, other than this online edition. "We must retire from all outward objects and silence all the desires and wandering imaginations of the mind, that in this profound silence of the whole soul, we may hearken to the ineffable voice of the divine teacher. We must listen with an attentive ear, for it is a still small voice. It is not indeed a voice uttered in words, as when a man speaks to a friend, but it is a perception infused by the secret operations and influences of the divine spirit." Mm-hmm. So the online edition says, "We must listen with an attentive ear, for it is a still small voice. It indeed can be a voice uttered in words, as when a man speaks to his friend."
Exact opposite.
And then
violation.
The original edition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you think they can get away with this because it was anonymous, or?
Well, it's what do you call it? Public domain. Mm-hmm. You know, like. So, since then, people have downloaded this, and they published it as A Guide to Two Peace in book form. So people will go and buy it, and they'll have this. Now, this is very interesting, and this is something I learned. And I have to give Rob the credit here. You know, like, when I first ran into that, I said, my impulse was, this is mendacious. You know, like, they're just, you know, this is just wicked. Like, so I'm going to sue them. If I could sue them, you know, like, and Rob said, he said, I don't think they are being mendacious. He says, and what he pointed out was that if you don't have the experience of interior silence, and you come across a passage like that, what will you do with it? You'll fix it. You'll make it better. You'll clarify what they really intended. And this opened up for me, you know, why is it that we have such trouble, you know, like the, you know, like texts, you know, various versions of texts, and scholars go over, you know, like there's this insertion and there's that insertion and there's this and there's that. Well, this is a text that's only 200 years old, so I was able to, you know, like trace all the changes, you know, like that happened to it. Because in a second, okay, just I'm going to finish this thought, you know, like, and I realized that Rob was right. And this is what I mean by the subtlety of interior silence. It's subtle in the sense that it has no shape, it has no form.
It's personal.
And it's personal. It's within. You know, like, and so here are these people, they love the guide, that, I mean, they're attracted to something or other about it, you know, like, and they run into this passage and they go, well, that can't be right. You know, like, the reason they feel it can't be right is because they haven't had the experience themselves. And since they like it, they'll say, well, you know, like, they must have meant the following. You know, like, it was a huge lesson for me. Yeah, Will.
But indeed, they really, the truth is that it is without a voice.
Yes.
A still small voice. That it is without anything else, and images. And because that... I mean, quietism goes all the way back, you alluded to it before,
Dionysus,
the Arabic guy, it goes all the way back to early Hesychism in the 2nd, 3rd century,
yeah.
When that was rooting up. Because if, and it's really a monastic movement that is just Quakers took over, you know, what was a monastic movement and put it into a layman's terms. Hesychism.
That's really
still
nice. I like the way you're putting it. That
yeah.
makes sense to me. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
So... it's helped me to understand discovering this. It's helped me to understand that sometimes I'm talking to people about this kind of spiritual practice, and then they'll go, oh, you know, and then they'll say something, and I go like, wow, they didn't understand what I was saying. I mean, I don't get angry about it or something like that, but this has helped me to understand how these teachings get lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like how they get sort of covered over. So. The people, who, you know, the individual who did this online, and incidentally, if you Google A Guide to Two Peace, that's the first thing that comes up, is this guy's altered version.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's the very first one, right at the top of Google.
Hmm.
You know, like, and...
Like Wikipedia.
Is that because it's the most recent?
I don't know. I think he gets a lot of hits.
Yeah.
You know, like...
By they, in some way.
Yeah, he may have, you know, like, but... It's sort of, you know, Rob allowed me to see it, you know, to step into that other individual's shoes, you know, like, and to realize that it is a subtle teaching. My Zen teacher used to say the problem with Zen is that it's too simple, you know, like that people want complexity. They want, you know, they want, you know, like, I call it mind candy. You know, like, I'm aware of my greed for mind candy. You know, like, I mean, I am almost insatiable about it. You know, like, so...
Clearly.
So I get it. You know, like, so... entering an interior silence, you're entering into a space... it is within, and it is personal, but it's also... I call it the presence of eternity... in the ephemeral individual. You're stepping into this space which is always present, never absent. You know, like, and it's beautiful. You know, it's beautiful and it's nourishing, and if you haven't done it and you haven't been aware of it, it seems impossible. And in fact, the guy talks about that. That many people will hear this teaching and they will think of it as a chimera of mere fanatics, you know, like, and that passage comes from Malabal and Stanley, Malabal, Guyon, and then the guy.
Say that again.
The chimera of what?
Mere fanatic.
Okay.
Oh.
You know, yeah.
I'm a lover of mind candy, too. And one of the journals I read of John Conley, early 1800s, I began to write down all the words he had to describe the experience. It did not include the word God. The river of goodness,
yes.
The fountain of light, the fountain of light and life. It is like a breeze that comes under the door gently, or it can be like a wind or a fire. And at one point, I don't think it's he, but who says, they have taken the tongue of God out of his head and chopped him up. So we no longer recognize the source with a capital S.
Thank you.
And I found in my own reading and looking for mind candy that I lost my way to the light, to God, by being so interested in history and mind candy. I had a candy shop, but no experience.
You put a lot of mind weight on. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, that. So, but we are beginning to run out of time, so I do want to move ahead. And the one aspect of the teaching of Quietism that I do want to touch on, because it's distinctive for the Quietist tradition, and I call it being passive to the light. And this is one of the things which got them in trouble. And it's one of the things which Howard Brinton points us out in his introduction to the 1979 edition, that this attitude is completely out of tune with contemporary times. The idea of simply being passive to the presence. He says that in the early Quakers actually used the word passive. That this is a passive form of prayer. That you're not doing anything.
Manifesting.
That you're not manifesting anything. That you're not striving. And the guide uses some beautiful metaphors, and these are from Backhouse and Jansen. I didn't find them in any of the source material before. They wrote this. And one of the metaphors they use is it's like raising the sail on a ship. You do have to pull away from the harbor. It does take a little effort, to get out of the dock. There is some initial sort of I really want to do this, but when you're out to sea, you simply raise the sail, the wind hits the sails, and you're off. You simply leave it to the wind. Another metaphor they use is nourishing dew, in the morning for plants. The plants don't strive for dew, the dew simply manifests as a gift from the rising sun. So it's those kinds of metaphors. Our age is an age of activism. It's just, in every religious community, and this kind of teaching is very hard for us to grasp, and I think it's one of the most valuable things that Quietism has to offer. This kind of surrender to the divine. It doesn't mean that you don't do anything. You actually, in order to understand this, I had to turn to Taoism. Taoism.
Oh.
The only spiritual tradition I know of that has a similar clarity about this being passive to the presence. So it's chapter 2 of the Tao Te Ching, the last section. The wise go about doing nothing, teaching, no talking. The 10,000 things rise and fall without cease, creating, yet not possessing, working, yet not taking credit, Work is done, then forgotten. Therefore, it lasts forever. All right. So this is remarkably similar to some of the things that Berkeley says. Now, Berkeley was a Westerner, so he had to use a lot more words. but it is the same kind of teaching, you know, like surrender to the present, you know, like, and that is the core of it, you know, like. So in chapter 5 of the guide, it says that you enter into this waiting worship, and then you accept whatever is granted in that period of interior silence. If you are given gifts, you know, like of what they call meltings of your negativities. You know, they don't use the word negativities. I can't remember the word they use, but then you accept that as a grace. You know, like it is not something you accomplished. Mm-hmm. You know, like you accept it as grace. If nothing happens during that period, then that is a gift as well. You know, like, and so, you know, the teaching is to whatever appears during this practice is a gift, you know, from the presence.
I just tend to interpret all of this, what you're saying, from my, uh-huh. You know, what I do, so hesychism.
Yeah.
So what I want to know is, where does, like, the Trinity or, like, Christ or, like, we were talking, you mentioned over there, you know, like the crucifixion or uh-huh. or Christ and atonement and all of that fit into that? I mean, because the presence to me means the Holy Spirit.
Yes.
Divine light, that's what it means. So, and the reason why I ask that is foundational to hesychism, which is an ancestor of what you're talking about, is, you know, the Trinity. So, and in fact, the presence is only, from hesychism, is only accessible through the Trinity. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering, I see the whole path laid out exactly like hesychism, which includes the Trinity for sure, and I just want to know, is the Trinity present in Quaker?
The question is too complicated for me to answer simply, you know, right now.
Yeah.
Quakers don't do theology.
Yeah, I know that.
So you'll actually find Quakers who are Trinitarians and Quakers who are not concerned
right.
with that. The closest the Quaker tradition has come to theology is Berkeley's 1670-something treatise called An Apology for the True Christian Divinity,
mm-hmm.
Which is a beautiful work, just wonderful. But it's actually, in my opinion, not a work of theology. It is an apology. He wrote it at the time that the Quaker community was being persecuted, and it's a defense of the Quaker, an apology for the peculiar practices of Quakers in England at that time. You know, like, I'm not aware of a single Quaker theological work, either in the evangelical branch or in the liberal branch, or in the conservative branch, because their view was the experience of the inner light, which is opened up through interior silence, trumps all of that. You know, like the, and but I'm sure it's more complicated than that. But that's the quick answer I can yeah. give you. You know, like,
Brinson does talk about the foundation is the light.
Yes.
For Quakers, and that's an amazing revelation for me, and knowing, understanding when I read him, how extraordinary, essential, integral to the beginning of Quakerism. But he defends that using theology.
Yeah.
He does.
He was theologically oriented. That's
yeah.
true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
How do the Mennonites fit in with Quaker? Because, you know,
they were a roughly contemporaneous movement. Maybe they started about a century earlier, and they historically they are considered to be one of the peace churches. So So the Quakers, the Mennonites, Amish, Plymouth Brethren are considered to be peace churches in that pacifism is a central concern. The Mennonites are much more theologically structured than the Quakers, and their churches are much more organized. They have, for example, bishops and ministers and things like that, whereas the Quaker tradition had no paid clergy. Like, another difference is that from the very beginning, the Quakers had women ministers, and the Mennonites, Anabaptist tradition, like every other Christian tradition, was skeptical or forbid that. Okay. Good.
There is a way you can say that Quakerism is a Stone Age, pre-Stone Age.
Oh dear!
No, stop! It goes back to Adam and Eve. That God has always been there to teach and lead anyone who would respond.
Yeah.
All right.
That's it.
All right. Thank you, sir. All right. Short and sweet. We are. I love this. There are two things I want to touch on before we leave. One is a passage that I found from Malabal. And since he's so little known, I wanted to read this because I think it's very beautiful and very inspiring. Remember, he writes this in the form of a dialogue. So here is the director speaking to his student, whose name is Philothea. You must remind yourself, Philothea, that the whole world is full of God and that he is everywhere, not only by his grace and his virtue, but also because of his very nature. There is not a single atom on the earth, not a single drop in all the depths of the sea, not a particle in the air or a point in the globes of the heavens where God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is not whole and complete. He is also complete and entire in animals, plants, minerals, and in all their smallest parts, of which there is an infinity in each one of his creatures. It is, to speak more exactly, and according to the rigor of theology, that all things are in God. For we do not say that the sea is in the sponge, but we say, on the contrary, that the sponge is in the sea, of which it is full within, without, and on every side, and in all its substance. Consequently, Philothea, God is in yourself, without your seeking him outside of you. He is in your body and in your soul. And if you would see how God is within you, or rather, how you are in God, you would find yourself so small, so lost in that immensity, that you would in truth be filled with fear. And you would recognize how of yourself you were nothing. What is a drop of water in the ocean? And have you never heard it said that the earth, however vast it may seem to us, is but a speck in regard to the firmament in which it is enclosed? A fact which astronomers demonstrate daily. What are we then, you and I, Philothea, considered in the infinite ocean of the divine, but nothings endowed with a little life, who would not know how to subsist or to act out of the divine any more than a fish out of water? What happiness to be always in God, and how little recognized that happiness is. It is the sun which shines on us and in us, night and day, and we will not deign to open our eyes to look at it. We remain in darkness in the very midst of light, and we are lukewarm and without heat in the very midst of the fire which surrounds us. Open your eyes, Philothea, by a lively faith that God is in you, and you will be at once in his presence. For contemplation is nothing but a loving regard fixed on a present God. Isn't that a... Now, remember that Malabar was blind, so he's talking about the light and all, you know, like, he had an experience of the inner light, so that's what he's speaking of.
Even when he talks of open your eyes.
Open your eyes. Yeah. You know, like, so... So, thank you very much. I really enjoyed. I do want to just touch on... there's the annotated guide, there's the Guide to True Peace, and there's this book by an Australian Quaker by the name of David Johnson, which also touches on the prayer of interior silence from a Quaker perspective. And there's this book called Eastern Light, Awakening to Presence in Zen, Quakerism, and Christianity. You know, like, so this is very interesting. I think this is by a Brit, but I'm not sure. You know, like, and so take a look at these. And I want to thank you very much for...
What's the name of your book?
An annotated edition
okay.
of A Guide to True Peace. So thank you very much for coming tonight.
Thank you again for continuing your string of wonderful talks here at Many Rivers. And thank you all for coming out tonight. Most of you know the drill. We have a donation bowl over there. We encourage you to contribute to it to help maintain this space and to help support our speakers in their ongoing work. Jim is indefatigable until he drops at some point in the future, and until then, your support will help him in his work. So thank you so much for coming tonight, and do check out these books.
Should I hit this button?